I think a year ago, I talked here about this document that I'd written for the Zen Center called The Ethical Principles of the San Francisco Zen Center. And I'm not going to go into that tonight, except to say that there was one sentence, one line in that document that confession, repentance, and forgiveness are time-honored Mahayana practices. And many people at the Zen Center read this document and were happy with it and worked on it a little bit. And basically, I was able to slip in this word forgiveness right to the very end of the process, until very recently someone said, wait a minute. Forgiveness is not a Buddhist concept. And I kind of knew that, but I thought it was... I didn't think anybody else would have studied Buddhism well enough to pick that up. And but I had noticed this, a very curious phenomena. And it's very interesting that Spirit Rock, a Vipassana community, talks a lot about forgiveness, but never talks about confession. The San Francisco Zen Center never talks about forgiveness, but talks a lot about confession. And so what's the division? What's the difference between these two? What does that represent? Well, I'm not going to go into that. someone pointed out recently that this forgiveness doesn't belong there. And so the committee then that's working on this draft, we discussed it, there's three of us, and I was outvoted about its presence there, even though I should know better. And what was said was that forgiveness is not a Buddhist concept, but what is, and what they consider to be comparable, is the idea of understanding, and from understanding, accepting. So understanding and accepting, as opposed to forgiveness. So this is kind of not a particularly good introduction to the talk exactly, but the talk is about what I want to talk about tonight, or what I want to try to talk about or do is explore emotions, the nature of emotions, and try to understand it a little bit from different angles, points of view, because a very important part of any kind of mindfulness practice is learning to, we use the expression work, but that's a funny word, learning to become mindful of what we in the West we call our emotional life. And what we're trying to do in the practice is to understand it so that we can accept it. But it often goes in circles. We can only really understand that which we accept. So it kind of builds. We understand a little bit, we accept some, then we can understand a little bit more, and so it goes. So in starting this, I wanted to say that from the point of view of mindfulness practice, or what you begin to see and perceive as the mindfulness takes hold, is that emotions are often not what they appear to be. Or maybe more accurately, emotions are often not what we think they are on the surface. And many of us in the West have opinions about emotions. And we kind of lump them together as being this thing. There are people will write manifestos or about what they feel about emotions. You know, it's important to express your emotions, it's important to do this with your emotions, that with your emotions. And it's like, it's very, very important. People will fight over, kill over their opinion about emotions. And I couldn't resist but to read this that maybe some of you have seen before. It's the Sylvia cartoon, comic strip. And someone goes to the psychic and she's sitting there reading her crystal ball. And this woman says, "My husband won't talk about his feelings." And the psychic says, "Oh, what a surprise." And the woman says, "Well, what's happening?" "Well, I'm looking at my crystal ball and my spirit guide is about to speak." And the spirit guide says, "In June of 1997, men will begin talking about their feelings. Women all over America will be sorry in minutes." So anyway, we have all kinds of ideas about emotions and who expresses it and who doesn't and the problems with it. And I'm kind of taken by the Star Trek character Data, who is always trying to, seems to be always wanting to become human. And it seems like the primary thing he lacks is emotions and humor. And it seems one of the characteristics of being really fully alive and being human is that our ability to feel emotions, which we're feeling all the time. It's a constant kind of thing that's happening. And many of the our favorite ways of being alive, favorite kind of experiences of being alive, things that give life meaning, I would say are emotions, emotional experiences perhaps. Feels all kinds of joys, feelings of compassion and love, of gratitude, and others perhaps. And emotions are a constant part of our life, much more than I think in the kind of surface engagement with our life we realize. It's a very interesting exercise that I do sometimes, mindfulness exercise, and that is when I'm driving, I like to do especially when I'm driving in the freeway, that's where I seem to do it, is I start paying, I'll pay attention to driving, of course, but I pay attention to what's going on with my emotions, my feelings, in the moment as I'm driving, and to the subtleties of it. And it becomes this, this kaleidoscope of change. And there's often like a prevailing mood, you know, that kind of, you know, if someone asked me how you're feeling, I'd say, oh, you know, whatever, it's, you know, I'm angry. But within that, there's all these subtle changes that happens, or other little emotions are constantly arising and passing, arising and passing. And so, you know, someone pulls up a little bit too closely to me, you know, like, you know, we're driving along parallel and they come a little bit too closely, and fear arises. You know, or I look in the rearview mirror and a cop car is there, and fear. Or if, you know, someone pulls up in front of me suddenly and I feel angry. Or someone, you know, has that beautiful car that I've been lusting after. You know, we're trying not to talk about Lexus anymore. you know, and so then, you know, there's whatever feelings come with lust, you know. So, and what I find is there's constant little shifts going on all the time. Fear and anger and apprehension and joy and delight and appreciation and awe and all these things that are moving within this larger field of my grand mood that I think I'm sitting in. And so I find this really fun and fascinating way to drive and to pay attention to whether the emotional response I'm having in the moment, regardless of how subtle it is, does it have to do with what's happening in the present moment? Or does it have to do with something that's happened yesterday that's going to happen in the future? What, is it about the present or is it outside the present? When I drove over here this evening, I got in my car and I noticed that the emotional state I was in for the first few minutes of driving had nothing to do with being with driving, completely something other event, until I got into Middlefield and things started happening and then I had other responses and reactions. Now, many of the emotional responses we have throughout the day are very subtle. And if you do this exercise, you'll become aware of how much of our emotional life goes unnoticed. It isn't just simply the men in Sylvia who don't, you know their emotions very well. But I think most of us, actually, are relatively unaware of the subtleties, the subtle shifts up and down and changes that go on virtually moment by moment, even though there might be this larger mood that within that's happening. We might perhaps, or sometimes we might feel some vague sense of dis-ease, but we're not really clear what's exactly happening. We feel a kind of general dis-ease, but we haven't taken the time to really identify, oh, this is how I'm feeling. A couple of years ago, I was feeling kind of out of sorts, not feeling very well, I remember. And I didn't quite know how I felt, but I certainly was tired and everything. So I laid down, and I laid there trying to feel and sense, what is it I'm feeling? What is it I'm feeling? And I could feel this tension in my chest, and my kind of rib cage was kind of extended, and couldn't really relax properly as I breathed out. And what am I feeling? And finally, I came upon the word depressed. And as soon as this word depressed arised, it was like it pushed this button and said, aha, that's it. And then my chest relaxed. And identifying an emotion sometimes will release some of the ways in which it's held. Not all of it necessarily, but some of it. And learning to articulate very carefully what the emotions are, it can be very important in this freeing, releasing process that is a potential in any moment. But then some people don't always know how, or don't know how to distinguish what they're feeling. Or they don't know how to distinguish between different kinds of emotions, between anger, depression, or anxiety. It just, you know, can't really tell the difference. It's all kind of a diffuse emotional storm. And I've read recently that some eating disorders arise because, arise together with the fact that some people can't distinguish between emotions like anger and anxiety, depression, and hunger. And because they can't distinguish between those, they think maybe everything is an expression of hunger, and so they eat. Now, if we recognize that a lot of this, at least the subtlety of our emotion in life, goes unnoticed in the way we're engaged in a normal life, when we're preoccupied by things, then we can maybe reflect on how the emotional tone or the mood often builds on each other. Anger, in a sense, builds on anger, or irritation builds on anger. If you enter the Highway 101 at rush hour traffic, and you're already in an irritable mood, you know, watch out. And you can get very angry if someone cuts you off. But if you go into the same traffic and you just feel just really great, you know, and this wonderful thing has just happened to your life and you feel like you're on top of the clouds and you couldn't care less what happens to you, and someone cuts you off, and it doesn't really trigger the same thing. If you go on the 101 with a neutral state, you maybe if your predisposition is such, you might get angry. But if you enter not neutral, but already irritated, it isn't simply that you get angry and that's it, but it builds and it adds to the overall mood. And it has a way of perfuming or adding or building until, it can be actually have major consequences. So if we discount these subtle emotions, we don't pay attention to them, then the cumulative effect of these over time can linger. And sometimes people are surprised at suddenly when they do wake up at how we're feeling, surprised, where did that come from? Why am I feeling this? Not having seen, actually, there was a whole long day of slow cumulative kind of reactions and responses that led to it. And I've kind of explained a little bit here the way in which our mind and our reactive emotions were kind of in chain reactions. You know, you feel angry, then you're angry with yourself for being angry again, and then you're depressed for being angry with your anger again, and then you blame yourself for being bad, and then it kind of goes on and on and on. But it isn't just simply it's a chain of associated emotions or reactions, but each of them kind of perfumes our being to some degree, and that perfuming kind of has a cumulative effect. So learning to notice the emotions is one of the most important things we do in relationship to emotions in mindfulness practice. When we look at emotions directly, it seems, I haven't studied this, you know, in a serious way, except in my own mindfulness practice, but it seems that you can maybe distinguish between two kinds of emotions. And I call them, maybe other people have also, primary emotions and secondary emotions. And what I mean by primary emotions are the raw, pre-verbal, automatic responses to a situation. And it seems that the mind is wired in such a way that if the mountain lion jumps in front of you to attack, you will jump out of the way before your mind recognizes that's a mountain lion. And it's a very useful thing for minds to do that because you get kind of a little bit of advantage in the moment it takes, the extra little fraction of a second takes to identify that's a mountain lion, it's already too late. So there's automatic responses, instincts, the reflexes that we have. you know, come with feelings like fear or anger, or I don't know what some of the primary emotions might be, but there are these kind of pre-verbal, in a sense, emotional responses. And you find many people who say, look, who want to celebrate or validate or simply point out that there's a whole non-verbal aspect to emotions. And if you try to verbalize too much or explain or talk about it, then you're not really in touch, or you lose touch with this pre-verbal aspect. I don't know how far into our normal life this instinct level goes. I have no idea, actually, what's pre-verbal and what's not. It's not that often we'd run into mountain lions in Palo Alto. Now, so that's a primary. The secondary kind of emotions are those that come, that arise out, in part out of an appraisal of the situation, an evaluation of the situation we find ourselves in, out of a judgment or an associated ideation or thoughts or ideas about the situation. It arises out of the values we have in the situation, from our convictions, from the categories we have of good or bad. So, and there's a whole slew of emotions that arise because we have some idea that we've added into the situation, which we interpret the situation. And because of that interpretation, then there's an emotional response. So I have a few examples. I don't know if these are good, but the first one is the difference between fear and worry. Because fear can be many things, but fear can be about the mountain lion or something very real and tangible. Worry, as far as I can tell, is always a verbal event. Not a verbal, not simply verbal, but you know, talking to yourself. It's nothing about what's going on anywhere except what the words that are spinning around in your head over and over again, all kinds of ways. And it might have some relationship to reality out there, but it's certainly not this pre-verbal kind of instinctual emotion about what's going on. But it has to do with this verbal stuff. And once you're in the world of thought, spinning around, worrying about this and that and this and that, then you're into certainly a lot of our values, the projected ideas we have on reality, our judgments, and so forth. Maybe perhaps another example is someone does not appear for an appointment that they made with you. Say it's a date, you know, and you're waiting at outside this restaurant, and you're waiting and waiting, and 2-3 hours later, they're still not there. And so you're, you know, fuming. You know, how could they stood you up? It's one of the terrible things in life, to be stood up on a date. I know, it's happened to me. There you are, standing in the lobby of, what was it? Some big hotel. What am I doing in a big hotel? I was this long-haired hippie with a beard and barefoot, standing in this lobby, this big, shiny, waiting and waiting. And no one ever came. So many people, you know, when they get stood up that way, get angry. But that kind of anger, I propose, is about is not about anything really visible. It's about interpretation of what that all that means. And I think many of us have had the experience of being angry if someone didn't show up on time, and were fuming and everything, and then found out that something, they had a good reason. They had an accident, or they got sick or something that was beyond their control. And suddenly you forgive them because, you know, how could you have been angry? So we don't know the situation, what's really happening. And in the unknownness of it, in our, because of our judgments and everything, we add this idea, oh, this must have happened. They were being disrespectful. And therefore, the emotion of anger arises. Attitude towards our bodies. They're just ideas we have that come from where do they come from? All these ideas we have about our bodies, and what kind of body is the right kind of body to have this particular decade. A tremendous amount of emotional feelings arise in our culture out of how we feel the attitudes about our body. And these aren't primal kind of feelings, but they arise because of judgments which we've internalized, ideas that we've internalized. It gets very interesting, of course, because the evaluations, the judgments we have about situations often confuses the more primary emotional response in a situation, perhaps, emotions confused or mixed up. So for one, I talked a couple of weeks about compassion. And it's very easy to confuse guilt for compassion, or to pepper your compassion with a good, healthy dosage of guilt, or fear, or mix anger up with compassion. Or some people will feel a lot of guilt or fear, anger in a situation, and think what they're feeling is compassion, because it's, you're really moved, you're excited, and you've been influenced by a situation, there's suffering out there, and you feel, oh, you know, it's I'm not guilty, I'm just feeling great compassion in this situation. Guilt can arise in the presence of suffering. Guilt can arise from the idea that I don't deserve to be happy, for example, in relationship to this other person who's suffering. And that's an idea. And out of this idea, then this feeling of guilt arises. And guilt in Buddhism is considered to be a form of aversion, a kind of anger, a kind of hate. And there's actually never any place in Buddhism for guilt. Guilt is never considered to be a wholesome emotion or feeling. It has no place in Buddhist practice. Or fear can be confused for compassion, and fear can be a feeling that it's too risky for me to get involved in this situation. You know, it's threatening to get involved. So this feeling of threat or fear arises, but that's an evaluation of the situation. And sometimes it might be an accurate one, but sometimes it might not be. Anger arises sometimes out of the judgment or the idea that I should have been able to control things. I should have been able to prevent that person from dying, for example. I should have been able to do something. I should have been able to do the X, Y, and Z. So the evaluation of the situation happens, and because of that, a feeling of guilt or anger or whatever might arise. Anger sometimes affixes blame or scorn on those in situations where we can't control what's the outcome. For example, people get angry at aging. What good is it to get angry with your aging? But some people get angry at the fact that they have to age. It's out of their control. Or to get sick, people get angry because they've gotten sick. I think most people sooner or later get angry. How could it be right now? I have a date. Or whatever, something important. So important part of mindfulness then is investigation, is the understanding of what's actually this phenomena that we've met, that's arisen in our life, in our experience. And emotions, as we investigate them, are not seen as fixed things. If you really look carefully at emotion, it's not a solid, fixed, absolute thing, which in the midst of an emotional storm, you think this is going to last forever. You know, this is really consequential. An interesting thought exercise is to take the most difficult emotion that you've ever had in your life. You look back through your life and think, what was the most difficult emotional thing you found yourself in? And then ask yourself, where is it now? But in the middle of it, we think that it's going to last forever. That's kind of the sense of it. If we look very, very carefully, we find that emotions actually last a very short time. What lasts, especially the more primary ones, what lasts for a long time is the evaluations that fuel or trigger the emotions. Evaluative emotions last for a long time because we can continue to reevaluate moment by moment. The mountain lion jumps in front of you and you run away. It's best if you can just kind of, you know, once you're safe, forget about it and go on with your life. And that's what we do. I mean, look at you know, a cat. You know, how quickly a cat, for example, can go from fear to complete contentness. So the kind of more primary relationships flow quite freely and quickly. The evaluations of it often locks things in place. So the great difference that we need to understand between anger and resentment. Anger is a free flow of emotion, can be. Resentment is when evaluation locks it in place. I'm not going to forgive that sucker, no way. I'm going to hold that then, you know. So we hold that feeling of anger and it becomes resentment. The word emotion literally means to move out. It's something that's in motion because they're always changing and expressing themselves and coming out. And learning the changeableness of the emotion in life is one of the ways we learn to be at ease with our emotions. So you can pay attention to your emotions as you sit here listening to this too. What we're looking for in mindfulness is not so much to free up our emotions so they can flow freely, but rather what we're looking for is to free up our awareness. And we put the emphasis, I think, on awareness rather than on emotions. Because we focus on emotions too much, and the goal is to free up our emotional life so it flows freely, then we might get caught in the content of our life. If we focus on freeing up awareness, then we're maybe more the wider process that holds the content of our life. And so we're trying to free up our awareness so it's not locked on anything in particular. Emotions often arise from each other. And I've given the example here of what I've learned up on Skyline at night when someone comes against me at night with their high beams on. And I noticed I got angry, really pissed. And then I started paying attention to why am I getting angry? And for a long time I didn't notice anything except that I got angry pretty quickly when they didn't turn their high beams off. And then, because I kept going back and every chance I had to investigate when this happened, eventually I saw that just before the anger, I mean just like a fraction before, there was fear. And the fear then triggered the anger. And when I can identify the fear, then now each time it happens, I can linger with fear. The fear doesn't have to trigger itself into anger. And it's much more, I think, reasonable or useful for me to take into account the fear over the situation than it is to kind of act out of the anger. So sometimes emotions arise from other emotions. And we see it in some people, for example, some people's arrogance, so-called seeming arrogance, seems to arise out of their insecurity. Or a humble, apologetic person might actually be full of contempt, and the apologetic kind of approach is kind of covering the sense of contempt that they have. Fear might be a predominant emotion, but the fear really is a fear of our own anger. Anger is threatening to us. Something about ourselves is sort of threatening. We're afraid of our capacity to love or to love itself. A lot of people are afraid of their strength, and so they hold back and don't express themselves because they're afraid of what might happen because if they express their strength. Emotions are seldom distinct, unshaded by other emotions. So grief, for example, can be full of guilt and blame and anger. Love sometimes might be fear, maybe full of fear sometimes, or even hate. Perhaps sometimes because of the high risk involved with loving someone. And that stimulates a lot of other emotions and feelings. I think one of the things that we can, maybe it's ideal, but we aim towards in mindfulness practice, is not to have no emotions at all. Emotions will happen no matter what. But rather is to have uncomplicated emotions. Rather, if you get angry, have uncomplicated anger. If you have grief, uncomplicated joy, uncomplicated love. Rather than adding all the judgment evaluations to it that makes it complicated with all kinds of other feelings and reactions. With mindfulness practice, our capacity to feel emotions will increase. And this is not, and mindfulness is not a matter of indulging in emotions. It's not a matter of giving preference to our emotional life or to celebrating or validating our emotional life. It's simply a matter of being with what, kind of matter-of-factly being with what actually arises, but allowing yourself to become sensitive. This gets very interesting, however, emotions, as we go look more carefully at what are emotions. And if a lot of the emotions are evaluative in nature, we look more carefully, what is these evaluations, these ideas that stimulate many of our emotional reactions? The primary one that I think Buddhism sometimes looks in is those evaluations, those ideas that have to do with some concept or idea or image of ourself, a self-concept. And a lot of our emotional life arises out of that self-concept. So, for example, again, guilt. Guilt arises out of, you have to have a judgment first that the self is bad or wrong. And with that judgment, then, there can be guilt. This feeling of guilt can arise. Anger can arise when the self is hurt or threatened, which can be many things that can threaten the sense of self. Sometimes it's our sense of integrity which is threatened, and perhaps anger is a healthy response. But what if it's our self-image, and it's a crazy self-image? You know, if you know, I mean, my sense of creativity is very poor, so I think about, you know, these fancy cars. You know, and if my sense of identity is tied into this fancy car, you know, and that's who I need to be in order to show off and be properly macho and have this car with a great big engine. And then, you know, someone dents it and has to go in the shop, I get angry. Not so much because, you know, it's a nuisance, but because now I have to drive this, you know, beat up old Volkswagen the shop gives me as a loner. And it's just not my self-identity. You know, how can I go on this important date in this old beat up Beetle? You know, how is she going to know that I'm really a macho kind of guy without that big engine? And so this is maybe a little bit absurd, but this self-identity, the way we think about ourselves, the concept, the way we want to project ourselves to ourselves and to others, those kind of ideas, we protect it, it's threatened, we try to build on it, we do all kinds of things in relationship to it, and those things tend to stimulate emotions, some emotions. So fear, when this sense of self is threatened. Interesting one is boredom. When things around us or within us don't seem to relate to our sense of self at all. When things threaten our sense of self, we get very interested. We wake up. When someone praises our sense of self, we also wake up. Isn't this quite nice? But if nothing, either praising it or putting it down happens, we fall asleep. We get bored. Joy can arise out of course many, many different things, but in relationship to a self-concept, it can come, for example, when the self-concept is reinforced. Someone kind of pats me on the shoulder and say, you know, you're kind of a great macho kind of guy. I'm going to light right up and make my day. Maybe. So to become aware of how many of our feelings, ideas, and judgments cluster tightly around a self-concept is to realize how much of the way we think, feel, perceive is, I have written down here, arbitrary and unnecessary. I don't know if that's exactly the right word, but if it just, you know, if I need to be macho for my sense of self-identity, is it, you know, how necessary is that? I mean, most of you are going to say, oh, get out, you're not necessary. You kind of relax, Gil. You know, but that's easier for you to tell me than not. Because if I'm not macho enough, I don't know who I am. And that's kind of frightening. So religions talk a lot about the death of the small sense of self. That these self-concepts that so much stuff constellates around needs to, in a sense, die. Many religions talk about that. And, you know, it's one way of looking at it. Perhaps it's based on our predisposition, whether you see the cup half full or half empty. You can say the small sense has to die, or you can say there has to be a birth of some infinite sense of self, or some infinite sense of being. Life and death commingle or coexist, so it depends how you want to look at it. But I think it's often because of the fear associated with realizing how much of our life is constellated around a self-image. And we can see that for the first time really clearly. It can be very frightening for people because, oh my God, what do I have to do? You know, I don't want to let go of this, or I don't know what to do if I let go of it. It means so many of the old patterns in which I live my life, I have to let go of because they're based on this old concept of self. The self-concept provides a sense of security for many people. So many people then fear the death part of dying, letting the small sense of self die. The old way of looking at the world. And I think perhaps it's kind of be useful to adopt the five stages of dying from Kubler-Ross, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, kind of as a heuristic device. To look a little bit on how we sometimes relate to our spiritual practice, to our meditation, to meditation practice itself, as ways in which we respond when the underlying sense of self, the underlying basic kind of unnecessary way of seeing the world and ourself, is challenged or threatened, and we have to let go. The small sense of self has to die. And you know, probably many of you know these five steps she has. She originally described them as being five stages people progress through. And since her time, most researchers now, I think, say that these are just five different kind of responses people have. And there's no, you know, you're not doing it wrong if you don't go through the five stages. Yeah, I died wrong. Shucks. So the first, you know, is denial. And that, you know, so avoiding practice for anything that seems more important. And, you know, classic one, of course, is work. You know, we lose ourselves in work rather than letting the small self die. It's a lot easier to work. It's a lot easier to overwork yourself than it is to be honest. So people do that. They do take the easy way out. And so they work 60 hours a day, a week, or whatever. The classic one is, you know, you can't meditate because you have to clean the refrigerator or clean the garage. You know, something else is really important. The refrigerator has to be cleaned. Or simply you rationalize, I don't have to practice. I don't have to do this. You know, I'm in touch with my feelings well enough, or you know, all kinds of rationalizations that might come up. Some denial of entering into the world, entering into that mindful place where we're challenged in our deepest attachments to a sense of self. The second stage is anger. So we get angry. We get angry at ourselves for putting ourselves in this predicament. We get angry at the practice itself. You know, this is a stupid practice. We get angry with the teacher. You know, and sometimes I get to these other people, a tremendous amount of anger gets projected on me. And sometimes probably it's justified. But I don't think it's all, I mean, sometimes it's just, I where is it coming from? You know, so teachers get it. We sign blame. We get resentful as a way of coping with the tremendous challenge of dying to the small sense of self or entering in close into this realm. And then there's a stage of bargaining. Well, I'll do this practice. I'll do this if it makes me better, or if it makes me, my headaches go away, I'll be willing to go into this. Or so it's kind of like bargaining or trading off, or it's kind of the effort to keep a small sense of self by giving up something. I'm willing to give up my wealth, for example, to be a proper spiritual person. I'll give up my wealth, but not my identity. So I can, you know, I can't really do this, but what does it take to become really spiritual? Well, I'll give up my wealth, I'll give up my sexuality, I'll give up, you know, you name the classic spiritual thing we give up. Anything but my identity. I'll assume a new identity, a spiritual identity. The fourth one is depression. We get confused, it's too confusing. We give up, we give in to the situation, we feel kind of despair. We lose our inspiration to practice. We lose our inspiration of why it's important to do this work, why it's important to face the attachment to self, why the possibility of a wider, greater, more awakened life beyond it, if we let go of it. We lose sight of the possibility. And often people sometimes come to this situation in their spiritual practice where they can't seem to be able to go forward anymore into where they feel like they have to go, and they can't go back either. They can't go back to where they were before either. And they're kind of in limbo, depressed and despairing and uninspired, kind of stuck here and kind of in practice. And then luckily, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross gives us the fifth stage, which is acceptance, and which works well with the theme of the understanding and accepting. And acceptance, my kind of synonym for accepting is trust. To come to a place where we understand and we accept and we have trust. We trust life enough that we don't need to hold a self-identity, a self-concept. We don't have to hold on tightly and project it everywhere we go. But we can trust enough. What is it like to be in life, to go through life, without having to be anybody in particular? You still have all your emotional responses and feelings and thoughts and intelligence, but and joys and delights, but you're not being someone as you go through life. One of the Buddhist kind of little cliche definitions of what a self is, the self is resistance. It's air drag. Wind drag is the word. What the self is a wind drag. What is it like not to have the wind drag? So when we meditate, one of the things that it's very difficult to do this. It's not, you know, meditation, mindfulness practice is not easy. But the offering when you sit down to meditate is that this is a time where you can temporarily drop all your responsibilities, drop all your blames, all your guilt, drop everything except the knowing. Except knowing, oh, this is what's happening now. This is what's happening now. This is what's happening. So do that as an experiment. Next time you meditate, drop everything except the knowing. Stay awake as you stay present in the sitting and see who you might really be. So emotions are complicated events. They're not to be taken for granted or just taken for the surface of them. But it's very valuable to go into them mindfully and begin sensing our way, feeling our way into the layers and the corners and the crannies of what our emotional life is all about. And it's a very important aspect of mindfulness practice to do that. So, thank you all.